On the 21st of December 2018, the First Step Act, or S-756, was passed into law, and it was held as a landmark passage, one that was desperately needed and that would change the American justice system for the better, making it more equitable and more humane. While it is just the first step, as the name implies, it was treated with such fanfare and such excitement that many thought this was the law to end the discriminatory practices of the justice system. We took a few weeks to let the fanfare die down and to study the text of the law to determine if it really was worth all the excitement. On this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we are going to be diving into the First Step Act of 2018.
Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
So welcome back to the first edition of Lessons from the Screen of the 2019 year. And this is still the show where we give you a review of whether or not any information that you can get through any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You're welcome. Lessons from the Screen is still sponsored by PAX Inc., a Black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for Black people in America through education, culture shift, and economics. You can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's PAXINC.org. Show them some love. Do the Learning Center and see what they got in there. New stuff added every day. Donate, volunteer, tell a friend to tell a friend. Shop at Amazon using their code so that they get donations. Do whatever you can to help them because they're doing whatever they can to help. So this show, we're going to be diving into the First Step Act of 2018. So we're going to get right into it. Like we do it every time that we have one of these documents or these activities that are kind of long and in-depth, go through it, and I give you my opinion as we go on the various things that we're going over. So the law is broken up into five sections. First section is recidivism reduction. Next section is the Bureau of Prisons, secure firearm storage. The next section is restraints on pregnant prisoners. The next section is sentencing reform. The next section is Second Chance Act of 2007, reauthorization. And finally, we have the miscellaneous criminal justice, various things going on there with regards to changing various components of the criminal justice system. So we're going to jump right on into section one, recidivism reduction. So this section mandates that the Attorney General create a report on the risk and needs of inmates and delivers that report to Congress within 210 days of the passage of the law. So that means that a report should be given to Congress by July 19th of 2019. The assessment should also be made available to the public via the DOJ website, and this report is supposed to determine recidivism risk and classify inmates based on that risk. It is also supposed to assess and determine the potential for violence or serious misconduct and to determine the type and amount of recidivism reduction programming needed. Assign the prisoners based on the assessment and then reassess and reassign periodically, not more than 1 year. But no other time period really is given for how frequently or how often the reassessments or the reassignments are supposed to occur. No information about how in-depth or whether or not the reassignments or the reassessments have to be as in-depth or involved as the first assessments, and no real information about the depth. There are some structures and some guidelines given, but no real information about the depth necessary even in the initial assessment. So in this whole program of recidivism classification is really the bulk of what this criminal justice reform. I got my rabbit ears up. Criminal justice reform is really the bulk of what this thing is about. This section is by far the longest section in the document. And much of the meat of what's going on here is based in this recidivism reduction assessment and assignment and programming. So moving forward, prisoners are also supposed to be given the opportunity to reduce their classification through participating in reduction programming courses and being reassessed. The assignment of the programs and the programs themselves. So the assignment of the people to the programs and the programs themselves, as well as the evidence used to validate and approve a program, are all left to the Attorney General. He's given that power exclusively, with very little direct overhead or really insight into what is required or what they're going to be looking for outside of reducing recidivism. And there are a bunch of different ways that you can do that. But anyways, so we currently have a classification system that does a lot of what's mentioned in this section with regards to housing and grouping similarly classified personnel together, benefits and a sentence. So recidivism classifications are already in. Here's the thing, right? So recidivism classifications are already implemented as a part of inmate classifications in some state prisons. So it's not even that the program that is really the meat of this reform is new or anything like that. Like, this is something that's already done in several state prisons. But anyways, prisoners who are successfully participating in recidivism reduction programs can be rewarded at the warden's choosing by getting up to 30 minutes per day, phone privileges or video conferencing privileges, additional visitation time. They can also be transferred to institutions closer to their residence, provided that there is a bed available at the transfer facility and that the inmate's security designation match up with the security designation of the facility. Prisoners can also earn time credits at a rate of 10 days for every 30 days of successful participation in evidence-based recidivism reduction reprogramming. It's about to say reprogramming. Or productive activities. Now, prisoners who are at low risk for recidivation or for, you know, finding themselves back in prison, who have not had their risk increase over two consecutive assessments, earn an additional 5 days of time credit for every 30 days. So they would earn a total of 15 days for every 30 days of successful participation. Now, there are some restrictions on this program. One being that it isn't retroactive. So it's not like if you've been participating in a program already that's considered a recidivism reduction program, that you're going to get all of this time credit served right away. It's not retroactive, so it's not going to work like that. It's going to be from this point forward. Another one is that it doesn't apply to inmates that haven't officially started their sentence. So inmates that are awaiting sentencing or that are still going through trial, but they're in custody as they go through trial, they can't participate. Others are if you are in prison for destruction of aircraft or aircraft facilities. And here's where you get into this whole spiel where it's like the side effects of a late night drug that they're trying to sell to you on an infomercial. So bear with me. I'm not going to read through all of it, but I'm going to go through a decent chunk. So if you destroy an aircraft or aircraft facilities, motor vehicles or motor vehicle facilities, drive-by shootings, if you're a part of those, if you are caught up in arson, assaulting someone, resisting or impeding officers or employees using deadly or dangerous weapons, or inflicting bodily harm. More restrictions include assault with the intent to commit murder, assault resulting in substantial bodily injury to a partner or child, influencing, impeding, or retaliating against a federal official by injuring a family member, female genital mutilation, habitual domestic assaulters, crimes involving biological or chemical weapons, assassinations, kidnappings, and assault of congressional, cabinet, or Supreme Court personnel, involvement in criminal street gangs, relating to prisoners in custody of an institutional officer, gathering or transmitting or transferring defense information, gathering or delivering defense information to aid a foreign government, explosives or information about explosives except fireworks, relating to threats against the president or successors and former presidents, unlawful possession or use of a firearm during a crime, computer fraud, genocide and most types of murder, kidnapping, peonage, slavery, human trafficking, mutiny and riots, killing an unborn child, sexual abuse, including against children, terrorism, aiding and assisting illegal immigrants in crossing the border, and on and on and on and on and on in specific detail of the various things mentioned above. So, again, it's just like one of the side effects of those infomercial commercials. So, and to these time credits, they also don't get you off for free. They earn you supervised release, which basically amounts to probation. And these time credits, even without the restrictions, will be hard to get into these programs. The federal prison system already has programs that give you time credits, such as the READAP program, which is a program that helps drug offenders kick the habit. If you complete the 500-hour program, they take 12 months off your sentence. But the program is so difficult to get into that there are scammers out there taking advantage of people with saying that they have hidden tricks or they can guarantee that their loved one can gain entry into the program if they pay them such and such money. It's almost become like an elite college club to be able to get into this program. So all of this sounds nice on paper, but these programs already exist in varying capacities and they aren't working for various reasons. Now, when it comes to the systemic impact, I didn't see anything in here that would fix a lot of those shortcomings beyond making more programs, which could, in theory, make it easier to get into a program if you have more programs. But there is also no guarantee that these new programs will actually come online or that the credits will actually be applied. Because, again, all of this is happening at the direction and the discretion of the Attorney General. Now, the law does give authority to remove earned credits for violations, but future credits can't be removed and the removal of credits must be put on paper and given to the inmate, along with the procedure for reacquiring lost credits. And the Attorney General also has the responsibility for training Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prison staff. The law does give recommendations to the Attorney General with regards to recidivism reduction assessments and programs, but I stress, as does the document, these are recommendations. Now, 2 years after the pass of this law, and every year thereafter for 5 years, the AG is instructed to submit a report to the various congressional committees on the activities of the DOJ in carrying out the directives of this law. And it also gives some guidelines on the metrics that should be used and how they should be calculated. But I don't trust that. And I talked about this when I talked over the climate change report. These reports are often late, if they happen at all, and nothing is done with them most of the time. If we go back to the climate change report, that law passed in the 90s, I do believe it was, and the first report was supposed to be produced in 2000. And the first report wasn't actually produced until 8 years later. It was 8 years late. And then it was supposed to be produced every 4 years. But in addition to the first one being 8 years late, the next one was, I think, another year or two late. So these reports, oftentimes, they don't come. When they do come, what happens to them? Absolutely nothing. So I'm not really excited about them wanting to see more reports. It'd be nice if they did something with all the extra information. But we know that Congress has a ton of information that they're not doing anything with right now. So why would I be excited about them getting more? Section 102 is focused on the implementation of the system and provides more recommendations. It states that 180 days after the AG releases his risk and needs assessment system, the Bureau of Prisons shall implement that system. That means that we should see this system come online on or before January 5, 2020, and all prisoners should be classified or should start being classified according to their recidivism rates. Jack that word all up, but I got it out. Bear with me. Now, the Bureau of Prisons has 2 years from the implementation start date to classify all prisoners by recidivism rate, which means that it should be completed on or before January 5, 2022. Priority for program inclusion will be based on proximity to release, and the wardens are authorized and instructed to enter into partnerships with organizations to provide recidivism reduction programs, and all prisoners shall be provided with the opportunity to actively participate in a program throughout their entire incarceration, with priority given to medium and high-risk prisoners for the recidivism reduction programs, while minimum to low-risk prisoners have priority with regards to protection activities. So they're going to be your laborers. Now, the law also amends the good time credit from 54 days per year maximum on sentence actually served to sentence imposed, allowing prisoners to earn a few more days of good behavior credit. Now, this does help out because it allows prisoners to earn more good time credit to get out sooner by focusing on how much time they were actually sentenced instead of how much time they actually served. A lot of the times they don't serve as much time as they're actually sentenced to. Now, it does go out to some alternate means of monitoring supervised persons after their release, and pre-release custody is spelled out with regards to home confinement and residential reentry centers, both of which can be revoked for violations. The increased ability to remove time from a sentence, as I said earlier, even though it might seem limited, it's still beneficial. And, you know, we got to be fair and we got to be balanced. So that's still a good thing. Now, I will point out here that having the opportunity to participate and the ability to participate are two different things contextually from my frame of reference. So hear me out. It's like low-income kids, they have the opportunity. Everyone has the quote-unquote opportunity, the chance, the possibility, and I'm using opportunity in the same vein as those things, to go to college. Everyone does in America. The door is open to all who meet the requirements. But low-income kids often don't have the ability to go to college because they lack the funds or the adequate preparation due to low quality middle and high schools in their neighborhoods. So while the opportunity does have a positive connotation and it's definitely better than saying a possibility, it's still not guaranteed and it's not a mandate. And so much power being left at the discretion of the AG, that worries me a bit when it comes to these programs. I will also point out that, like I just said, this is all at the discretion of the discretion of the warden and the AG. A person, not a system, not an organized structure, not an institution with rules and things of that nature. It's basically at the whims, the opinions, and the moods of a person, which introduces a level of randomness that isn't going to be beneficial for inmates trying to figure out how to navigate the whims of a new person in charge. They also might have to contend with the new person in charge that doesn't agree with the old programs or metrics and cuts programs that were favorable to them. This becomes particularly dangerous from the standpoint of, we have to acknowledge that the way, the how, and the purpose that are infused into programs when they are created often color the program for the remainder of its life, or at least for a good chunk of its early development. Meaning that if the people that are appointed move fast enough, all of this power being solidified, because much of it already existed in the hands of an AG that was picked by the Trump administration, could make disparities even worse and the system even more unfair for Black people. That has to be stated. This section, section 103, goes on to lay out the GOA report, the Government Accountability Office report. And this section lays out that on or before January 5th, 2022, the Comptroller General of the United States will conduct the audit of the program and its effects. The audit is supposed to be including information on racial demographics and be conducted every 2 years afterwards. Now, as I have said and will continue saying, there are no guarantees that the report will be created and no indication that there will be anything done with the report once it is created. Section 104 authorizes appropriations and basically approves and authorizes the spending of $75 million a year through 2023 for the programs. 80% is reserved for the director of the Bureau of Prisons to implement the system created by the AG. Any savings created by lower incarceration due to a reduction in the recidivism rates, those are to be reinvested into the program. Now, here's what's probably, for me, the biggest kicker in the nuts of this thing. Section 105, one of the biggest. There are a few, but this is definitely one of them. Section 105 goes into the rule of construction. And this section basically says that none of this stuff applies to people in state prisons, which constitutes 91% of the inmates in America. So this stuff only applies to roughly 10% of the total prison population. Federal prisons are mostly political prisoners, white-collar criminals, and things of that nature. So even to that, while blacks outnumber whites in state prisons, whites outnumber blacks in federal prisons. 60% of those people in federal prisons are white. 40% of them are black. And while we are still disproportionately represented, the law, the raw beneficiaries of this law are shifted dramatically when it becomes a federal prison-only endeavor. Of the 2 million black people in prison, over 2 million black people in prison, estimates upwards of 2.3 to 2.4 million black people in prison, only 70,000 of them are in federal prison. So out of 2.3 million black people in prison, only 70,000 of them are in a federal prison where this law would even apply to them. There are more black people in prison than there are white people. Raw numbers. But on the federal level, there are more white people incarcerated on the federal level than black people. So I said that twice because I want to accentuate what I'm trying to say here. I want to just drive it home a bit. They cut their homeboys some slack. They ignore the vast majority of the disproportionate and disparate and disequal treatment in the criminal justice system by focusing only on federal prisons. Now, I understand people are going to feel like, you know, they didn't want to overreach states this and states rights that. And I get all that. That's the same argument we had when the Civil War broke out, states rights. But the federal government does have power to implement changes on the state level. So that also poses the question of why do we continue to fight for the federal government to get involved in the prison reform discussion and ignore state level political endeavors? That's another show. From my perspective, in terms of the black community, this alone should dampen, if not completely terminate, all excitement about this law. Pause for dramatic effect. Section 106, moving on, faith-based considerations. This basically allows faith-based organizations to participate in the program. Section 107, independent review. Within 30 days of this law passing, so January 20th, running on up on that, an independent review committee of at least 6 people appointed by the National Institute of Justice will be formed to assist the AG in carrying out this law. 2 of the people have to be peer-reviewed pub papers. They have to have peer-reviewed published papers. meaning they have to be academics. Two must be corrections practitioners who have developed and implemented programs like this one before. And one person must have expertise in assessing risk assessment implementation. And they will generate research and reports and offer recommendations to the AG and the BOP for carrying out this program, this system, no later than 2 years after the passage of this law. So 21 December to 2020, they will present a report to Congress, and they will be disbanded 2 years after the risk needs assessment system is released. The entirety of section one, I'll say again, is specific when it wants to be, such as disqualifying measures for the recidivism reduction time credits program. But on the whole, it's largely inspecific. Is restating powers that already exist and adding new directives that don't really mean anything and lack clarity, and asking for reports that we aren't even sure will be generated. And if they are generated, we're not even sure if anything's going to be done with them. Not to mention that the entire thing is focused on federal prisons, and I just finished ranting about that. I see nothing in the first section to be excited about outside of the potential opportunity for people to earn more good time credit. Kudos. So section two, and you can relax. Section one, like I said before, is by far the longest section, by far. So things are going to speed up quickly here, because that was basically the bulk of prison reform, what I just gave you. So moving on here, we got section two. Section two basically provides a secure storage area located outside of the secure perimeter of the institution for employees to store firearms. It also gives the option to store firearms in a vehicle in an approved lockbox and allows employees to carry concealed firearms on the premises outside of the security perimeter. Now, this section is the result of a corrections officer that was killed in Puerto Rico, I believe it was, no less, ironically. That was believed to be a retaliation for work at his prison. The section is actually named after him, and I'm not going to butcher his name, so I'm not going to say it, but you can go look it up. And is an inclusion of another act into this one. The belief being that if he had his gun, he wouldn't have been killed on the expressway he was driving on when he was shot. Now, I don't see this as having much of an impact to affect, you know, anything positive or negative when it comes to the masses or to the black community. This is more or less, in my opinion, a political point grabber. This tragic thing happened where this inmate was targeted for this corrections officer was targeted for assassination by some inmates, and he was killed, and they want to score political brownie points, and that's why this is in here. So, yay. So section three, we're talking about restraints on pregnant prisoners being prohibited. This section makes it illegal to restrain a pregnant inmate during labor, delivery, or postpartum recovery unless the inmate is deemed a flight risk, dangerous, or otherwise in need of restraints as deemed by a medical professional or a U.S. Marshal. Now, if restraints are to be used, the least restrictive restraints must be selected. And if restraints are used, a report must be generated for each use within 30 days of use. All of this is fine and dandy, and I agree with it. But like other things that I've mentioned, this was already on the books. Like, it was already like illegal. It was already prohibited to restrain pregnant prisoners during their delivery. Like, that was already there. There is literally a law saying this exact same thing on the books right now. But since that law isn't being followed, Congress decided that they would issue another one rather than enforcing the old one, which brings us to the real dilemma with all these laws. How will they be enforced? And will they be enforced? This law means absolutely nothing without enforcement. Matter of fact, it's just doubling down on something that's already happening. And since they opted to pass a new law instead of enforcing the old one, I question the impact of this section altogether. I'm sorry, pregnant women, but you can look forward to still being strapped down while you're delivering your baby. This law means absolutely nothing because the last law meant absolutely nothing. So, and forgive me on that last part, I said this law means absolutely nothing. What I meant to say was this section means absolutely nothing, because this is all one law. So section 4 is sentencing reform, and this is the part that got black people really excited. And understandably so. We do, anytime you hear something like sentencing reform, you get excited because you think, well, it can't possibly get worse. And so you get excited. And so I'm not mad, I'm not blaming, I'm not, you know, attacking anyone for being excited about seeing sentencing reform. But let's dig into what sentencing reform actually means within the context and the confines of this document, this law. This section makes amendments to laws that have already passed. Well, let's start there. In particular, it changes the 20-year mandatory sentencing for repeat felony drug offenses from 20 years to 15 years. We shave 5 years off. It also changes the mandatory sentencing for a third conviction from life without release to 25 years or more. So that's that three strikes you're out rule. It used to be, 10-20 life? When it came to drug convictions, those of you in Florida, you have your own 10-20 life when it comes to committing crimes with a weapon. But here, this is a different thing. So they've reduced third convictions from life without the possibility of parole or early release to 25 years or more. So depending on your age, you know, a life sentence is 50 years. In some states, I believe it is, most places. So they basically chopped it in half. So that's nothing to sneeze at. That's pretty decent. But it adds the term serious to a couple lines of text, changing them from felony drug convictions to serious felony drug convictions. Now, the difference between a serious felony and a felony are classifications in the U.S. code. Serious felonies tend to carry harsher punishments. And they also, when it comes to drugs, tend to deal with more restricted drugs on more classified or more restrictive code list. And this theme is carried on with many of the mandatory minimums being reduced by 5 years and many drug felonies being upgraded to require serious drug felony convictions instead for the sentence. And these are all significant, but the most significant is that all of this is retroactive to include the changes in the disparity between crack and cocaine made by the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 while Obama was president. So while Obama was president, Congress did reduce the gap. And if you know 2010, I was in that first 2-year window when he had a Democratic Congress and he could pass virtually anything he wanted. So they did pass laws to reduce the sentencing disparity, which created a large portion of the inequality in the prison system to begin with, where a 1 gram of cocaine powder, pure powder cocaine, which is actually more powerful than crack, was, you know, there was a gap between somebody that got sentenced for having 1 gram of cocaine and somebody that got sentenced for having 1 gram of powder. Are 1 gram of crack. And I can't remember what the actual numbers were. I should have looked it up to make sure. I knew at one point, but it slips my mind right now. But we're all familiar with it. I think it was something like 1 to 100 years or something like that, or 10 to 100 years. It was some crazy number where people getting caught with the less powerful, cheaper version of the substance were getting punished exponentially harder than people that were caught with the more expensive powder, more powerful form of the substance. So he did something to reduce that Congress, that government did something to reduce that, because it's not all on the president. Congress makes the laws. But in any case, the changes made with the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 were not retroactive, not all of them. And this section actually makes those changes retroactive, potentially freeing thousands of inmates by affecting their sentences. Now, Section 402 gives judges more discretion to disregard mandatory minimum sentences for people with limited criminal histories. Originally, judges had to follow mandatory minimums if a convicted person had any criminal history. But this new amendment allows for 4 1-point criminal history infractions, 1 3-point offense or infraction, and 1 2-point infraction. And all of the point systems and all of that things are determined by the sentencing guidelines. If you're interested in that, you can look that stuff up. Section 404 ends by saying Nothing in this section shall be construed. Now, this is the second kicker in the nuts. Pay attention to this. Pay attention to it. Pay attention to me. Hear me. Open your ears. Nothing in this section shall be construed to require a court to reduce any sentence pursuant to this section. This basically means you have to be approved for the sentencing reductions. It is not guaranteed. Everybody was running around talking about, 3,000, 4,000, 10,000, 8,000, all these inmates are going to be released from prison by the passage of this law. Guaranteed, this is going to happen. That section with that sentence basically states, no, it is not guaranteed, and it should not be construed to guarantee. Pause for dramatic effect. Now, this section has some great things ruined by the fact that it all needs to be approved. None of it is mandatory. None of it is mandated. None of it is guaranteed. The reduction in mandatory minimums is a great thing, but the extra leeway given to judges doesn't automatically translate to better sentencing for Black people. We know from study after study, as well as from real life experiences, that Black people are given harsher sentences for a variety of reasons centered around beliefs and views based on our skin color and our perceived culture. Now, while this was the section in particular that had the most Black people excited, this was the section that frustrated me the most, because you could see the compromises being made to pass it, and you could see Black people being sold off, similarly to the compromise of 1877 that ended Reconstruction. Now, this obviously isn't as bad as that. I'm being a bit dramatic, admittedly so. But I see what could have been a wonderful situation tarnished by compromises without our best interests at heart. And if their goal was truly to shrink the disparity in treatment, they would have pushed back against some of this stuff. But there's a whole political discourse surrounding why this thing was passed at this moment anyways, even though it's been sitting on somebody's desk for years. So, yeah. And then you add to that, all of this is accentuated by the fact, even the good parts, they're all accentuated by the fact that it only applies to federal prisons, which are majority white inmates. So Section 5 is the Second Chance Act of 2007 reauthorization. And this is a reauthorization for the Second Chance Act that was passed originally in 1968 and has been reauthorized over and over with minor changes. The purpose of this is to reduce recidivism by creating opportunities and tools that inmates can use to get back on their feet. And it has served to make a lot of organizations wealthy, but in terms of its impact on the Black community, it's been virtually non-existent. And this is evident by the increasing recidivism rate. Businesses don't hire ex-convicts. Ex-convicts have a social stigma around them. And for the Black community, they are also Black. This law does nothing to change their culture or the social stigma, so it does nothing to truly reduce recidivism. Convicts need more than a motivational speech and a shiny new skill to get back on their feet. They need opportunities and guarantees. And you can't incentivize this and it just have it happen just based off incentivization. Look at how many unemployed, homeless, and homeless vets there are. And there are all kinds of incentives to hire a veteran. That has to be something that starts in communities. And politically, it definitely helps to incentivize it. But realistically, that simply isn't enough. This law doesn't really do anything meaningful in that regard whatsoever. This section especially doesn't do anything meaningful to adjust the social stigmas surrounding ex-convicts. And it damn sure doesn't do anything to address the social stigmas surrounding being Black. So I don't see any major things happening. So Section 6 talks about the miscellaneous criminal justice system. This is various little odds and ends that they just wanted to tack on. And the first section of the miscellaneous things is focused on placing prisoners closer to families. And it sounds nice, but there was already a limited effort to do that. So this really means nothing, especially when you consider that prisons are full. A lot of them are at capacity. And this is all predicate on an open bed being at the place that you're trying to go. Section 602 provides for home confinement for low-income, low-risk prisoners, which, again, sounds good. And this might actually be good. I'm not trying to knock this at all. But I've seen how home confinement for supervised releases works against them, especially if they can't go anywhere, can't get a job. They're literally stuck on house arrest. They become a burden to friends and family. They face depression in some cases, not even getting into the trap that is parole. When you consider being released with the negative stigmas attached to being an ex-con and people seeing your detection, your monitoring device, and, you know, not being able to fully live or provide for yourself, it forces people back into a familiar territory for their comfort. And oftentimes that familiar territory is the same territory that they got in trouble in. A 603 allows for elderly and terminally ill persons to potentially be released early. And it's ironically called the Compassion Act or something like that. Let's be real. This got shit to do with compassion. They're talking about saving on the medical expenses for old people and the terminally ill persons. And that's the government shifting that burden from itself to friends and family, who are now going to have to take care of that person. And if they don't have anyone, then that person is going to die in short order because they're not going to be able to provide for their basic medical necessities. And a lot of these people are facing problems that were caused by some sort of maltreatment or mistreatment that they received while they were in prison. So in 604, it makes it so that released inmates are released with government identification, which is a good thing. That's a good thing. They need IDs. And they should be released with an ID. Section 605 allows inmates to more employment opportunities while in prison. And these are the same employment opportunities that people are now protesting as slave labor. Yeah, there are going to be more of them. It also allows prison created products to be sold in markets that were previously blocked, like nonprofits, the District of Columbia, and various other prison institutions, various other places like that. And it allows for the instructions for de-escalating. This isn't 605. This is just more miscellaneous stuff. Allows for providing instructions for de-escalation training for prison staff and treatment for the opioid and heroin abuse. Of course, we got to have something to treat all of these white folk that got caught up in opioid. Not knocking the white folk, not beating up on them, but there is a huge disparity in the way they treated the opioid epidemic versus the way they treated crack, cocaine, and heroin and all these things when black people were struggling in the 70s and 80s and 90s. So, you know, that's been spoken to death. So I'm not going to get back into that, but it is interesting that they have something in there for that. Various mentoring programs are included, ensuring supervision of sexually dangerous persons, which leads me to believe that sexually dangerous persons are not being adequately supervised now. Troubling thought, or maybe they just wanted to do what they've done at other places and reaffirm things that are already being done, things that should already being done. Free healthcare insurance for various types of medications for inmates. And finally, it places restrictions on solitary confinement in juvenile centers, basically saying they shouldn't happen, and if they do happen, it should happen under extremely specific circumstances and for not longer than 3 hours, but preferably keeping it under 30 minutes. And let me just tell you, that's been in the books. And as a former juvenile detention center resident, I can tell you from personal experience, those restrictions are being ignored and they will continue to be ignored. So, yeah. And that's basically what we have here. I've given you my opinion. I don't think it's anything to be celebrated. I don't think it's even worthy of being called prison criminal justice reform. That's almost an attack on my intelligence. You could call it prison reform, but the fact that it only affects less than 10% of the prison population, it's a struggle to even call it prison reform. You can call this bullshit. You can call it political grandstanding because it's been sitting on somebody's desk, and the only reason it passed was because the Republican Congress, the conservative Congress, wanted to give a conservative president, a president who, prior to becoming president, was actually a liberal and was for criminal justice reform. They wanted to give him a win because he spent the last 2 years getting his ass kicked. And they wanted to give him a win before he lost complete control of government when the Democrats came in. And they did. They gave him a win. The Democrats assisted in giving him this meaningless win that we should not be excited about, because a lot of it points to nowhere. And a lot of it highlights things that are already supposed to be being done. I don't get the excitement. And I understand it's just the first step. But let me ask you this. How often are first steps moved on? Obamacare was supposed to be a first step. They haven't done anything to improve Obamacare. Matter of fact, they've been doing everything they can to destroy and dismantle it. When does government ever go back and actually improve on the first steps? First steps tend to become permanent law. And so when we're looking at this as permanent law, especially from the standpoint of it being molded and crafted by conservatives and by the Trump administration, who is known to not really care for the blacks, that should make us more concerned. Now, the only good thing about this to me is that it ignores 90% of the prison population, which means that even if they do decide to go rogue with this thing and make it something stupid, it's not really going to affect us that much, because out of the 2.3 million black people in federal are in prison, only 70,000 of them are in federal prison. But if it goes good, then we can see that they were just throwing a bone to their homeboys. Now, what would I like to see in prison reform? Well, first off, 20% of the inmates in federal prison are actually in private prisons. Now, I know a lot of people are like, well, that's less than 10% of the total prison population. That's true, but federal prisons are leaning more towards privatized prisons. And I don't think the prison industry should be a for-profit private industry. So I would like to see that completely dismantled before it gets out of hand. I would like to see real sentencing reform on the other end of the spectrum, in terms of not just reducing the sentences or giving judges more leeway. I actually think there needs to be some guidelines for sentencing, because you give judges a bunch of leeway and that's what you start seeing problems with, their implicit biases manifesting themselves in their sentences. I'm not saying all judges, but I am saying we've seen enough studies and reports to believe that the majority of judges will be fair. I've got my own personal experience with regards to military judgments. It shows me that even the most well-meaning of white people in their own minds are still going to fuck up the majority of black people that they come across. So I would like to see something that mandates that first-time offenders don't get sentenced to prison, don't get sent to jail or anything like that. They get sent to some sort of program, some sort of alternative program that isn't going to end up on their record and mark them as an ex-con. Well, you could send them some sort of drug program for drug people where they go through the courts, they get found guilty, but they don't get sentenced to prison. They go to this drug rehab program. Or they're involved in violent activities, they get sentenced to this criminal anger management program, or this personal or character changing program, or something, some other type of program that keeps them out of the justice system. Because if you really want to stop the problems, you have to stop people from getting into the system. You can't fix the situation once they're in there. Our government is too heavily dependent on punishment instead of rehabilitation. And I understand a lot of people are saying this is the first step towards moving towards rehabilitation. But like I said earlier, I disagree with that assessment. You got to show me more before I believe this is the first step towards anything other than more political grandstanding. So with that being said, I just wanted to break it down. I gave you my opinion. I'm not going to go on and on and on about this, because I definitely could. But I would like to see more significant changes on the front end to prevent people from coming into the system, versus these changes being made on the back end to make things easier for them once they get out, which is a virtual impossibility on a political level. And with that being said, Drop me a line. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you think of my analysis, my assessment. Let me know what you think of some of my suggestions. Let me know if you agree, disagree. Find us on www.freedomtrainradio.com. You can also become a patron, but that'll come later. And get at me. Facebook, wherever you see me, if you see me in the streets, holla at me. See you next week.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trust, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the dots that you need to.
I want to thank you guys once again for tuning in to Lessons from the Screen. I also want to encourage you guys to head over to the website, www.freedomtrainnetwork.com. You can head over there to the website, gain access to all of the shows on the Freedom Train Network, including this one. You can access to old shows, new shows. You should also check out the Freedom Train app. You can find it in the Google Play Store. If you research Google Play or research Freedom Train Radio or Freedom Train Presents or Freedom Train Network, you'll find the app there and you'll see the Choo Choo Train. That is our trademark Choo Choo Train for the Freedom Train. You can get all of the shows right there on your cell phone. Notification whenever we drop anything, or maybe we just want to see the notification saying hi. So you should definitely go and get that app. And you should also take a listen to our live internet radio streams throughout the weekend. We're dropping lectures, we're dropping shows, we're dropping all kinds of interesting things on the weekends. So definitely take advantage of that. I want to thank you guys again for supporting us. And as always, we appreciate you. We'll see you next week. This is the Freedom Train Network Presents Lessons from the Screen.